What is going on, everyone? Welcome to the Taming the Financial Chaos podcast, where we embrace uncertainty, we embrace the chaos, because we are working to establish control. My name is Matt McCoy. I'm a financial advisor and a certified financial planning professional out of Greensboro, North Carolina. The name of my practice is Principles of Financial Planning. You can find us online at principles with an L-E of financialplanning.com. That's principles with an L-E of financialplanning.com. Ladies and gentlemen, how in the world are you? Thank you so much for joining us here today. Got another ESG podcast for you today. This is part three in our series. And where we're going to get started today is basically we're going to pick up with that problem solution paradigm that we left off with in our last podcast. And just as a quick refresher, you know, as it applies to ESG investing, ESG strategies are purportedly the solution to problems associated with ESG factors. And a key point to kind of use as a jumping off point here is, you know, when it comes to solutions, all things being equal, I think it's a pretty fair assertion to say that we all prefer the best solutions to our problems. And if that's the case, then what we mean by that is that first and foremost, we obviously want our problems fixed. So we want true solutions to our problems. But in addition to that, we want our problems fixed in the most efficient way possible. And so essentially that means we want the most efficacious solutions. Well, when it comes to evaluating a solution on the basis of efficacy, a basic first question to ask is whether a solution actually addresses the problem at hand. And a follow-up question of that would be what costs are sustained in the process. So for instance, what does it cost to produce the solution? Does the solution create other costs by creating other problems? Another way to put that might be to say, does the solution cause adverse effects? And given that absolutely nothing in life is free, a natural question that arises is whether the benefits of the solution are of such a magnitude and or the costs are so relatively insignificant that implementation is indicated, to use a medical term, or warranted, we might say. Well, so far what we've done in our ESG series here, I think we've done a fair job of covering the cost aspect of ESG. And so today what we're actually going to take a look at is what you might deem the benefit side of things, or the results, let's say. To do that, we're going to get a little more substantive. And in particular, what I've done is I've pulled a couple academic papers that we're going to review and talk about the key points of these papers, which essentially looked at the efficacy of ESG. Now, on that note, an interesting little point for me to add here is that it was actually hearing about one of these academic papers that prompted this entire series on ESG. Specifically, I heard about a paper from a Freakonomics Radio podcast. This was episode 546. It was released on June 14th of this year, 2023. And the title of the podcast was, Are ESG Investors Actually Helping the Environment? The Freakonomics podcast basically focused on an interview with a lady by the name of Kelly Hsu. She is a professor of both law and finance at Yale, and she, along with a colleague of hers from Boston College, Samuel Hartzmark, published a paper entitled Counterproductive Sustainable Investing, The Impact Elasticity of Brown and Green Firms. Now, as you might have already concluded, this paper and the Freakonomics podcast focused on the E in ESG, just like how we closed out our last podcast. In fact, one of the things that Hsu mentioned in her interview on the Freakonomics podcast was that it's always been strange to her that E, S, and G are bundled together. Now, in giving you the title of Hsu and Hartzmark's paper, there was obviously a reference to brown and green firms. So let's start there. What are those? Well, simply put, brown firms are those that emit the most carbon, and green firms are those that emit the least. And what Hsu and Hartzmark set out to evaluate specifically in their paper was how the carrot and stick approach of ESG investing impacts the emissions of companies. Now, what is meant by this carrot and stick approach? Well, to use a line from Hsu and Hartzmark's paper, ESG is an approach that, quote, rewards green firms by lowering their cost of capital and punishes brown firms by raising their cost of capital. Close quote. So green firms are rewarded or given the carrot, while brown firms are punished or given the stick. And as it turns out, there's basically a problem in the simple fact that the stick looms much larger than the carrot. If I were to summarize the conclusion that Hsu and Hartzmark reached in their paper, I would cite this line, quote, "If the dominant sustainable investing strategy of directing capital away from brown firms toward green firms succeeds in changing financing costs, such a strategy would be counterproductive in that it would make brown firms more brown without making green firms more green." Close quote. And they go on to explain that this focus, quote, "rewards green firms for economically trivial reductions in their already low levels of emissions." Close quotes. The simple reason for this is that if a firm's emissions are already low as compared to other firms, then it takes smaller improvements to result in larger percentage changes. Now, in case all of that doesn't seem very straightforward, let me give you a simple example to demonstrate what they're basically talking about. So let's say you've got brown firm A and green firm B, and brown firm A emits 100 units, whatever those are, of carbon, while green firm B emits only 10 units. Okay, so right off the bat, what I want to point out here is that just simply because of the number of units that these two firms are already emitting, they are classified as either being brown or green. Now, if brown firm A reduces its carbon emissions to 90 units, that's a 10% improvement or a 10% reduction, you know, 10 divided by 100. But for green firm B to achieve the same percentage improvement, it only has to reduce its emissions by one unit, because 1 divided by 10 is 10%. So again, the starting point matters when it comes to these companies. In the paper, Hsu and Hartzmark do give a good case study that they offer as their own demonstration of these issues, and it does a good job of going into additional detail and discussing some of the additional problems around this issue. And specifically, the two firms they compare here are Travelers and Martin Marietta Materials. Now, many of you are probably familiar with Travelers, and you know that it's an insurance company. And if you didn't know that, well, hopefully now you do. But many of you might also not be familiar with Martin Marietta Materials. They are a producer of heavy building materials. Now, what I would say right off the bat is that it would only seem natural that a company that produces heavy building materials would emit more carbon than an insurance company. And we can reasonably conclude that the building materials firm would be considered brown, while the insurance firm would be considered green. This line from the paper basically defines the problem at hand. Quote, "If Travelers were able to cut emissions by 100%, it would be the equivalent to Martin Marietta cutting its emissions by a mere 0.1%. So in other words, Martin Marietta reducing its emissions by 0.1% is the same thing as Travelers disappearing from the face of the earth. But as Hsu and Hartzmark explain, the nature of the problem goes deeper than that. Quote, "As an insurance firm, Travelers is also very unlikely to develop new green technology that could be adopted by other firms, or to manufacture building materials in a manner more environmentally friendly than Martin Marietta currently does." Close quote. So essentially, what they are alluding to is that consideration should be given to how improvements made by one company can be used by others, which could potentially lead to a compounding effect of benefits. But they go on, quote, "Martin Marietta has the capability of becoming much more green or brown. While the company emits a large amount of carbon, it does so after having made significant green investments to cut its emissions per ton of cement from 0.84 in 2016 to 0.77 in 2019. Martin Marietta has also considered a number of green investments for future adoption, although the firm currently deems them unprofitable absent additional financial incentives. Similarly, if the market forced Martin Marietta to worry about its short-term survival, the company could double down on its existing brown projects, which deliver relatively more front-loaded cash flows. Close quotes. And here's one more passage that's discussing this case study that's pretty remarkable. If Martin Marietta were to simply reverse the emission reductions it's made since 2016, it, quote, would result in an increase in emissions equal to 30 times travelers' annual level of emissions, close quotes. In other words, from 2016 to 2019, the reductions in emissions that were achieved by Martin Marietta were the equivalent to 30 travelers' insurance firms no longer existing. Ultimately, what Hsu and Hartzmark are basically arguing is that the current approach to ESG investing is more likely to cement the status quo, if not make things worse, as opposed to resulting in firms becoming more green. What they essentially say is that it makes more sense to evaluate improvements on the basis of comparisons across firms, not confining the evaluation to only the metrics of any specific firm. In other words, a firm like Martin Marietta should be seen as having made greater improvements than Travelers. But because the current way of evaluating these companies is on the basis of improvements relative to where they started, that's not being done. And so a firm like Travelers Insurance is seen as having made greater improvements than a firm like Martin Marietta. Something else that the case study of Travelers and Martin Marietta gives us is basically a taste for the types of firms that are considered brown and the types of firms that are considered green. And according to Hsu and Hartzmark, your typical brown firms are going to be found in agriculture, transportation, building materials, industries of that sort, while your typical green firms are going to be found in insurance, healthcare, legal services, and industries of that nature. Now, while it might not be all that surprising to hear the types of industries that would be found in each category, there are some pretty significant conclusions that can be drawn from that. If ESG's ultimate goal or ultimate result is to raise the cost of capital, so the cost of doing business for brown firms, and lower the cost of capital, so lower the cost of doing business for green firms, at minimum, we can say that the costs of the goods and services produced by brown firms are going to be more costly to the consumers as well. But more than that, it is at least theoretically possible that a brown firm could find itself in a position that might threaten its very existence. And the ultimate problem with that is that green firms do not produce goods and services that are substitutes for brown firms. So that ultimately means that the goods and services produced by brown firms may not even be available. Another paper that sheds light on the efficacy of ESG is entitled The ESG Innovation Disconnect, Evidence from Green Patenting. The authors of this paper are Lauren Cohen, and forgive me, I'm probably going to butcher these next two names, just like I did in the previous podcast, but Umit Gurin and Kwok Nguyen. Now, specifically, what the authors investigate in this paper is who produces green patents, the most influential of these green patent producers, and whether the capital of investors who desire to allocate capital toward ESG objectives actually do end up investing in these producers. Now, if I was to summarize the findings of this paper, I would offer this line, quote, "The majority of recent green patenting is not driven by highly rated ESG firms, the firms that are commonly favored by ESG funds, but instead by firms that are explicitly excluded from ESG funds' investment universe," close quotes. So, a basic translation, the companies that are driving most of the green innovation are disfavored by ESG standards. At minimum, that seems a little backwards. Now, the authors of this paper took a particular look at energy firms, and here are some key points and passages to summarize what they found. Energy firms have nearly three times the relative focus on green innovation in their innovation portfolios as compared to the average industry. Incremental green patents, which are those that are built upon previous innovations, are more likely to come from energy firms than any other type of firm, full stop. The green patents of energy producing firms are of a significantly higher quality. Energy firms are also significantly more likely to produce, quote, blockbuster green patents. Fossil fuel companies' green energy patents produce more kilowatts of alternative energy than those of green energy firms. Exxon holds the patent for one of the central and foundational components of the solar cell. Firms with higher environmental scoring produce fewer green patents on average. And as they state in their conclusion, quote, our analysis suggests there is a negative relationship between the generators of innovation that can help us confront environmental challenges and where capital is being directed. Our findings raise important questions as to whether the current exclusions of many ESG-focused policies, along with the increasing incidence of explicit divestiture campaigns, are optimal, or whether reward-based incentives would lead to more efficient, innovative outcomes. So essentially, they define the current ESG approach as one focused on singling out firms for punishment, and they question whether it would be more effective for it to be rewards-based. Now, to close things out here today, I'll leave you with a few thoughts. So papers like the ones we've discussed today begin with a hypothesis. And hypotheses come about because someone has experience and or education that is directly applicable to whatever the issue at hand happens to be. This background of experience and education tells the person that either something will work or won't work. And in fact, one of the things that Shu mentioned in her interview was that upon hearing about ESG investing, her immediate thought was that it violated basic principles of finance. Now, granted, Shu is apparently well-educated, but are the folks who run investment firms and develop investment strategies not also well-educated? So based on that, I've got two questions. Number one, what should we understand about the fact that the ESG architects seem not to have grasped what Shu understood? Otherwise, why would they have created these strategies? And number two, what should we make of the fact that seeing the outcomes of ESG investing, and particularly those of the sort that were covered by the papers we discussed today, that the architects don't seem to be adjusting their approach? Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Taming the Financial Chaos podcast. Just a quick reminder that you can find more information and resources about my practice online at principles with an L-E of financialplanning.com. That's principles with an L-E of financialplanning.com. I hope you will join us next time. And until then, take care and stay healthy. Securities and investment advisory services are offered through Lincoln Financial Securities Corporation, member SIPC. Insurance is offered through Lincoln affiliates and other companies. Lincoln Financial Securities and Principles of Financial Planning are separate entities. Lincoln Financial Securities and its representatives do not offer tax or legal advice. Individuals should consult their tax or legal professionals regarding their specific circumstances.